This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Whether Amendment 1 will boost or restrict solar power in Florida depends on whom you ask. Backers of the amendment say it will promote solar and protect consumers from scams and unfair subsidies, but opponents say it's an attempt by utility companies to choke off rooftop solar. Opponents of Amendment 1 are pointing to audio leak this week from a speech given by a Tallahassee think tank as evidence of foul play. Was it political jujitsu that got Amendment 1 on the ballot? Does more solar on rooftops mean Floridians who don't want it will be penalised? Just what kind of solar scams are Amendment 1 proponents worried about? By one measure, Florida ranks 14th in the nation for solar capacity, so what's the way forward? We're at 1-866-338-5252. Do you understand what Amendment 1 actually means? That's 1-866-338-5252. Well, joining us in the studio, Stephen Smith. He's on the board of directors with Floridians for Solar Choice, also executive director of the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Stephen, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
And also joining us from Tallahassee, Screven Watson. He's a board member with Consumers for Smart Solar. Screven, thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure to be here, Matt. Thank you.
Well, Screven, I want to start with you. Let's turn to that audio from that speech by Sal Nuzzo, the policy director of the free market think tank, the James Madison Institute. Now, he used words like political jujitsu, describing an incredibly savvy maneuver, talking about this amendment. I mean, is that accurate? Is that a good way to characterize it?
No, Matt, it wasn't. I mean, let me tell you right off the bat, I've been involved as a board member for the Consumers for Smart Solar since 2015, mm-hmm. early in 2015. I've never had an email, text, phone conversation, met anybody from the James Madison Institute. And I've been involved in this, getting the amendment on, going through the Supreme Court, and now trying to campaign for it, like I said, from the get-go. I've never had any interaction with James Madison. So, you know, and I think I read after that came out that the executive director said, look, we haven't worked with the Consumers for Smart Solar. I think it was a guy, and I don't know him, and I don't want to impugn anything negative on him, but I think it was a guy just trying to act like he was involved in something he wasn't, maybe a little smarter about things than he should have been. But I can just tell you emphatically, Matt, and 100%, we have no interaction with James Madison, so I really don't know what caused the guy to say that.
Okay, Screven, but when you have competing groups of petitioners gathering signatures for very similar-sounding solar initiatives, I mean, that's confusing for people. I've actually seen this happen. So were people tricked into getting this amendment on the ballot?
I don't think so, Matt, and let me give you a quick story. As you said, I'm in Tallahassee. Two or three or four times ran into petition gatherers around Tallahassee in mm-hmm. front of the place where you go pay your bills at the state fair here, the local North Florida fair. And each time I watched them, they had banners up talking about Amendment 1. They had fact sheets. They were interacting with voters, and there was no intent to deceive. I never saw anything that would do anything but read this language. This is what it's trying to do, and sign if you want. So, you know, I guess when you do have a lot of amendments out there on medical marijuana and solar, and there was a solar amendment in August.
Yep.
Yeah, there's a chance for people to not know which one is which, but I don't believe that there was any intent to deceive. In the signature gathering process.
Nonetheless, Screven Watson, Consumers for Smart Solar won this exchange, right? I mean, your petition is on the ballot, so that's the one that folks are going to be voting on in November, or voting from now, in fact.
Correct.
Well,
okay, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I just want to bring Stephen Smith in on the conversation. You know, some of the language of Amendment 1 warns about scams. I mean, is this a legitimate concern from your point of view where rooftop solar is concerned?
Well, let me go back and let's have a little straight talk here. The only scam that is being perpetuated is on the voters of Florida by the proponents of Amendment 1. I mean, Mr. Watson may want to throw this gentleman under the bus, but the reality is that James Madison Institute, on their board of directors, is the CEO of Gulf Power and another Gulf Power board member. And these are the utility companies that have put $22 million behind this. And this is the biggest fraud that has ever been perpetuated on Florida voters. The big utility companies, basically, let's just cut to the chase. They don't want solar in Florida because when people are generating their own power, they're buying less from the big utilities. follow the money. Well, that's what this is all about.
Is it that they don't want solar, or is it that they don't want to lose control of that sector of the market?
No, that's a good point. They are willing to do solar that they own and operate. But the issue here and what they're going after here is customer-owned solar. And that's why we have conservatives from across the political spectrum, businesses and progressives all behind this, because conservatives want free market competition. They want the ability to allow people to do solar. And these guys, what they've done is they've wrapped this language with a bunch of eye candy about promising rights that that citizens already have in Florida. They've been talking about consumer protections. There's no more consumer protections in this the day before or after the vote. But the poison pill in the middle of this thing, which they're going to use against customer-owned solar, is they're going to say that it's, quote-unquote, non-solar customers are subsidizing solar customers. There's no truth to that. That has been debunked. But the utilities are going to use that at the Public Service Commission level to bring punitive charges on customer-owned solar. And this is a way that they're going to control the market. Remember, they are a monopoly. They have no competition. And when customers are generating their own power, the utilities are vehemently opposed to that. And that's why else would they be spending $22 million? They don't care about, they're not really pro-solar. They're building natural gas plants. They're building nuclear plants. That's how they get more into their rate base. Mm-hmm. What they don't want is they don't want customers generating their own power because they're buying less from them. You got to vote no on one. Vote no on. No is the vote if you are pro-solar. No is the vote that gets you the more solar in the state of Florida.
Listen to Stephen Smith with Floridians for Solar Choice. Certainly, Scriven, just a moment, though. And also from Tallahassee, Scriven Watson, board member with Consumers for Smart Solar. We want to take your calls, too, 1-866-338-5252. What are your thoughts when you look at Amendment 1? Do you think it's a good deal for Floridians, or are you a little bit concerned about it? 1-866-338-5252. Scriven, a lot to unpack in that there from Stephen Smith. Is there an intent to deceive? Do you describe this as a poison pill? How do those words sit with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's so much that Steve just went through that you know. But let me sum it up this way: Amendment. You have a lot of very intelligent listeners, and I know that they will look and research and read the language of Amendment 1. And in fact, several things. Number one, let me just take a quick second. Amendment 1 really does two things. And in one thing, Steve's right. We put solar in the Constitution where it doesn't exist now. Now, Steve says that we have the right to do that now. He's absolutely correct. Mm-hmm. You do. But it's an implied right. It's a right because it's not prohibited. And so even Chief Justice Kennedy in the Supreme Court said, look, it is putting a right that currently you don't have in the Constitution in the Constitution. Number two is about the government and consumer protection. Again, what Steve says is slightly right, is that we leave government, Matt, in the process. We leave them in the process to whether it's protect consumers or as we just discussed, you know, look at the fairness issue. Government retains their ability. It doesn't grow. The financial impact study that looks at all of these amendments said several things. It said, number one, that it didn't create any new rules, any new hurdles, any new statutory constraints, didn't create any new government control. It simply retains government's ability. And number two,
Before that, Scriven, sure. Where did that financial impact statement come from? Who commissioned it?
It's the state. But when you put these constitutional amendments in the Constitution, each one mm-hmm. of them has to go through a fairly rigorous study by the same people who do the Amy Baker and their state. They work for the state. The same people do the Financial Revenue Estimating Conference, you know, every right. year for the legislature, so they know how much money they have to spend. It's the same group, and they mm-hmm. held 3 field hearings, and they do a deep dive, and they are actually the ones who write some of the language that you see on the ballot mm-hmm. and that talk about the financial impact. And so they said there was no new regulations, no new government powers, so to speak. And it also said there were no fees, no issues mm-hmm. to the consumers. There were no new fees. It didn't do any of that. So So those are the two things Amendment 1 does. It puts it in the Constitution, Matt, but it also lets government retain their authority to protect consumers. And I noticed that Steve didn't answer your question when it came to what sort of scams that this could protect.
That's because there are
no
scams.
We have seen in others. Well,
there are no scams in Florida. Well,
you're
dominating the conversation.
Well, let me finish, and then you can have your part. So in other states, if your listeners will Google Arizona solar fraud and things like that, they will see story after story of consumers that were bilked out of money and into long-term leases. And quite frankly, we've had a lot of it in Orlando, in the Orlando region. So all I'm saying to this is there are scams out there, and government would retain its ability to have oversight over things like consumer fraud and safety, and that's why, for example, the State Firefighters Association endorsed us, 25,000 members.
Okay,
let me have some straight talk.
Yeah,
here.
Sure.
Scriven, thanks for your input there. I do want to move to some callers here, and Stephen, I see you raising your hand.
Let me just two really quick points. Okay. First of all, does this gentleman sound like somebody who's pro solar? He's talking about false scams. This is why this is so deceptive. There's no scams going on in Florida other than this ballot on solar. The other thing is you don't monkey with the state constitution by putting things in. I mean, he's saying we've got to put solar in the state constitution. Well, what are you going to have next? The right to own automobiles, the right to own refrigerators, the right to own flashlights? I mean, that's not what. Well, that's right. That's why are you supporting that?
Well,
so that's the whole
Steve,
thing.
Let me explain.
So the
all right,
thing,
all right,
well,
all right.
Hold on.
Gentlemen, please. I'm going to take a call here. We'll rejoin you two folks
in just
a moment.
That's outrageous.
If in doubt, throw it out.
Stephen, just a moment. Let's take a call here. We've got
outrageous.
We've got Cliff calling from Kissimmee. Cliff, you're on the air. What are your thoughts about Amendment 1?
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Surely.
I got the ballot through. I have read the amendment very carefully, and it was actually the first one to which I entered no. I've been a solar enthusiast for a long time, and this amendment does nothing. I've got the proposals on my desk to install solar on my house. The hoops you have to jump through to get solar in Florida are already very tight. To the point, Arizona is the Wild West. Florida isn't. Florida's tightly controlled. It's good. The only reason for this is to protect the commercial oligopoly of the big power companies, I think. And as I say, I've got the proposal. On November the 9th, if you vote no, I'll be sending it in. If the power companies get their way, I'll tear it up and throw it away.
Well, Cliff, thank you so much for your call calling in. They're going to take another call. We'll take that other call in just a moment. But, Stephen, let me just come back to some questions here. And let's talk about Nevada. You know, there's one take talking about, and I'm reading here from an article in Wired magazine about solar power, taking a look at the language in Amendment 1 in Florida. Here's this quote from this article in Wired. In Nevada, recently passed a law that similarly allowed utility companies to charge rooftop solar users extra has basically killed the once booming solar industry there. End quote. Stephen Smith, is that a concern for you when you look at Amendment 1 language here?
It absolutely is, and that's the spot on point here. The big monopoly utilities have banded together across the country, and they see customer-owned solar as an implicit threat to their business model. And so what they've been doing is they've been making up false information to say that people aren't paying their fair share, that people are doing – they're not supporting the grid and all this other stuff. And we're talking about solar that is at penetration rates of less than 1%, and they're acting as if – you know, the sky is falling. The only thing that is falling is their shareholder profits. And that's why they're putting $22 million into this and using false information. This is deception at its core, and that's why voters need to vote no.
Scriven, I want to ask you a question, but let me just read something from the Solar Energy Industries Association here. Here's what they say about the state of solar power in Florida. Florida, quote, the Sunshine State, ranks third in the nation for rooftop solar potential, but all the way down at 14th for cumulative solar capacity installed. Florida's solar policies lag behind many other states in the nation, end quote. So that's how the things stand at the moment when you look at the Solar Energy Industry Association. Now, is locking in the status quo the way to go? And if not, what's the answer to getting more solar if the status quo isn't working?
Well, let me talk about a couple of things that you just raised. One, solar is growing in Florida. There's more solar jobs. We've gone from 6,500 solar-related jobs to 8,000 in the last year, a year and a half. Solar rooftop is growing now. It's important to note that some of those other states have mandatory alternative, you know, issues where Florida is voluntary. So in the voluntary states, we rank higher. But when you do compare us to places like California and others that have mandatory issues, we don't rank as high. But here's the thing about, you know, what Steve and some of his opponents say is, look, they, and we've heard some of it on this call, this parade of horribles, all these things that are going to happen. And simply, we leave the status quo. But under the status quo, let's talk real quickly about some things that have happened. Number one, they have sales tax exemptions and breaks when you buy solar power. The same government infrastructure that they say is stacked against them is the same group that put Amendment 4 on the ballot, which passed with 70-something percent of the
vote.
That's
the legislature.
That we have tax breaks.
The legislature.
We have, it's the same. And yeah, and we leave the legislature in this process, Steve. I mean, we leave the legislature in this process.
That's why we shouldn't have a constitutional amendment.
And to look at, you know, here's, I got to say this, because this, you talk about deceptive. You led a charge, and by the way, it's still out there to be put on the ballot. Your own third-party sales business models that will benefit out-of-state solar companies.
Nobody's voting on that
this
year. That's
fine.
This year, we're
voting
on the deception.
But you still tried to put it in the Constitution, and you just said, oh, wow, you guys are trying to put something in the Constitution where it doesn't belong.
We're not putting something in the Constitution in this vote.
All right, all right.
That's very disingenuous.
Folks, yeah. I feel that we're getting a little trying to do this. I feel we're getting a little off track here. I'm going to take another call. We've got Debbie calling in from Lake County, talking about Amendment 1 and the ballot language there. Debbie, when you look at this amendment, what do you see? Is it confusing? Is it a straightforward amendment? And what are your thoughts?
Well, what I'm seeing is that I think that this is going to be to benefit the energy producers. Duke Energy's come out in favor of it, and I was duped like a lot of Floridians when they voted for the Amendment 1 for the water, whether we were going to protect the Everglades. And it ended up being where it went to legislature, where they could interpret it. And that's what I see with this. And it's really very sad because, you know, in Florida, just like these other states where we have all the sunshine, you would think that we would be getting most of our energy from solar power. But, you know, not wanting this to happen and, I'm
going to
vote no.
Okay. Thanks for your call, Debbie. I appreciate it. Scriven, I mean, could the language have been written a little more clearly and simply in this amendment for voters' benefit?
I just really don't know how it could. I mean, basically, if you read it, there's three parts. It gives puts a right in the Constitution in Part A. Part B, it says government retains its ability to stay involved in the process. And number three, it simply says that because government stays involved in the process, that they can be there to make sure that down the line, not today, not tomorrow, not next year, but if some point government thinks that consumers are being treated unfairly because those who can't afford solar or choose not to have solar are somehow having some cost shift to them to maintain the grid. It doesn't say, and I need to be clear about this, Matt, it doesn't put that presumption in the Constitution. You can't. We would have been thrown off the ballot if we tried to put some legal presumption in the Constitution. It just simply says government retains its abilities to be involved in the process. And that lady that just called, I want to make one comment. I mean, we do talk about a lot about the utilities being involved. We're happy to have their support. You know, passing these things is not a simple proposition in Florida when you're going up against Trump
and the money
they're putting
Hillary
into it, all that in the airwaves. But I do want to say, you know, we have the professional firefighters that have come out and endorsed this, the Florida NAACP, the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, the Farm Bureau, the Hispanic Chamber of Commerce. Those aren't the utility companies, Matt. These are people that represent thousands of Floridians that have the same concerns we do about consumers being treated fairly.
Scriven, thanks for your time. And I will point out that you may have support from those folks, but a lot of the money is coming from those big utility backers. So thanks for your time. Anyway, Scriven Watson, board member for Consumers for Smart Solar, also joined by Stephen Smith with Floridians for Solar Choice. So thank you both so much for shedding some light on this issue. Still to come, the Milk District is the latest Orlando neighborhood to join the city's Main Street program. Some residents say the neighborhood's character character is under threat from new development. So what can the Main Street program do for the Milk District? Intersection returns in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Milk District is the latest Orlando neighbourhood to join the Main Street program. The city will provide funding and support to help revitalise the area and preserve its character. I visited the Milk District's Space Bar and met with bar owner Tommy Mott and Main Street administrator Pauline Eaton.
Let's start with you, Pauline. What is the Main Street program and what does it mean to add another district to it?
Well, the Main Street program is a national program. It's a subsidiary of the National Trust for Historic Preservation, and it was started back in 1980, so it's been around quite a long time. And the City of Orlando is the contracting agency that holds a coordinating program. So we have to abide by the rules that were given by Main Street America, and part of that is we get to decide about designating different districts into our program. So we have criteria that we ask them to do, and we've been working with the Milk District for a while to get them ready to come into the program. And part of what we do then at the city is train the volunteers, get them all organized with a nonprofit, and then work with them to make their districts better places. So we're really excited to have our 10th one in, and the Milk District is, a lot of people already thought they were in, so they're just a great district, and we think they'll be a good addition to the program.
Now, practically, what does it mean? Do you give them money? How do you help the Milk District now they are part of the Main Street program?
We do. Not all Main Street coordinating programs around the country do that, but when we set the program up here in Orlando almost 9 years ago now, we did make a part of that financial assistance. It is a matching program, so the district has to raise funds on their own, cash, no money that they've done or bartering or anything like that. It has to be cash match that they have to raise, and then the city puts some funds in to help them, like seed money, to get started. But the rest of it, mostly what we do is technical assistance and training and really a lot of hand-holding. I've been doing Main Street. I started where Tommy is as a volunteer like 24 years ago. And so I've been around the bend quite a bit. And so I've worked with probably over 200 Main Street programs in my career. And so a lot of what I do is just they call me on the phone. How do we do this? What do you think about this? And I come out a lot and help them with things, but they also get a lot of assistance from other city staff because the program is housed in the City of Orlando. So, for instance, a lot of times the planners will come out and give their input on things that have to do with either transportation or things that have to do with the look of the district, the feel of the district, and kind of give them some suggestions. We partner. We bring in a lot of partners to the program to help teach them how to raise funds. We pretty much are teaching them how to operate their business district more successfully.
Tommy Mott, what does it mean to you that this is now part of the Main Street program?
Well, it's nice to have a voice with the city, I think, is the main thing, because we just want some sustainable growth in the Milk District. As far as personally, it's interesting because I came up with the name and started it like way back, and it's taken a really long time to get here, but we're finally here, and I couldn't be more excited.
So you're the guy who christened this the Milk District?
Yeah, pretty much. I was the guy. I came up with the concept and idea, wanted to name the area. It was like in the early 2000s, back when my business was a skateboard shop, and I had two retail stores, and we had Etoile Boutique next door to us, and we were like, we got to do something, and came up with a name, and it took a while to get the name too. A lot of jokes and ribbing from friends, but here we are.
Tommy Mott, is the Milk District a bit of a victim of its own success now? I mean, you do see quite a bit of development, especially on the housing side of things. People want to move here, but is that always a good thing?
Yes, it is, and that's one of the things we're addressing right now. We've had a few meetings with developers and kind of getting the feel of what we want, and we're trying to lay some stuff out on paper. We, like I said, we want growth. We're not afraid of growth. We just want it to be sustainable and not change the look and feel of the area. You know, we've been going like probably 7-8 years as the Milk District, and it's grown just naturally and organically. Like Pauline said, everybody thought we were part of the Main Street already. Because we kind of have our stuff together in certain aspects. So, you know, we promote really well. We do really good events. And we've just been growing. So we are trying not to become a victim of our own success, basically. Yeah.
Now, on the intersection, we talked to Adam Wanis, who's a developer in the area. He's got a lot of duplexes going in, and we had some reaction to that interview. Some folks weren't too happy with what he had to say, but how do you work with people like Adam Wanis, other developers, to make sure that the look and feel of the Milk District doesn't change radically in a short space of time?
We've met with Adam once already now, and that was a really great meeting. And I know the city is putting in a design board for certain areas, so there's some changes happening to help these little districts, especially like ours, grow in a nice controlled way without, like I was saying, like just turning it into, I don't know, Brooklyn, where everything's overpriced. You know, the cool kids come in, they do something good, and then everybody wants to be a part of it, and then the guys with all the money come in and take over normally. And we're trying to, we want these guys with money to come in, but we don't want them to just take over and change everything, you know. To quote Mr. Wonis, and I'm not in any way being negative towards him, but like when he said, you know, I want another Thornton Park, and it's like, well, we're not Thornton Park. If you want to be Thornton Park, go to Thornton Park. You know, we're the Milk District. This is what we do. We're very diverse, all kinds of people, all kinds of incomes, all kinds of race, creed, color. We're really open, and we don't really care who you are, what you are, as long as you just want to grow with us and be cool, you know. So,
Pauline, let me ask you then. I mean, how much of your job sort of steering these neighborhoods as part of the Main Street program, how much of that is kind of like conflict resolution, helping people grow together rather than rub up against each other in the wrong way?
Yeah, that's a good question. It's quite a lot of it, actually. And when you were talking to Tommy, one of the things I wanted to interject is that's the beauty of the Main Street program is we're not a chamber of commerce. We are not just made up of business people and business owners, but it's an inclusive group that includes the developers, the property owners, the residents that live there, whether they're residents that own their property or rent. I mean, we want everybody. We want the corporations. We want the schools, the parks, everybody who's involved in the district to work together. So I know the Milk District folks that have started the program, they've reached out to Adam and they've had some meetings with him that I haven't been involved in those, but they've reported back to me that they've gone very well, that they've all, you know, kind of started this dialogue with one another. And I think that's the beauty of having this organized group, is that they can all work together and bring everybody into the fold, so to speak, so that they are kind of all working towards the same goals. Sometimes we are victims of our own success because, you know, that's just the way it is. But, you know, we try to manage that, as Tommy was saying, so that as we grow and as things progress, that, you know, the people that started it are able to grow and they're able to benefit from that growth as well.
When you look at a district, an area like the Milk District, how far in advance do you have to look to make sure that you're not trying to smooth things over after they've already happened rather than doing them before big change comes in?
It's kind of a balancing act. Sometimes we get it right. Sometimes, you know, your timing isn't all that great with that, but we try to come into the program from different angles. So I think when the Milk District first started talking to us...
And how long ago was that?
Oh, my goodness. You remember what year now? Probably 6 years ago,
yeah.
I would guess.
Maybe longer?
Maybe.
How long were you doing the Main Street?
We started the Main Street program in 2008.
So 2008, because I remember people telling me, hey, you got to go talk to this lady. They're doing something you need to be involved in. And that's how it all started. So at the same time, so we created the Milk District probably at the same time the city decided to do a Main Street program, and we just didn't, we never met. No, the city really didn't know what was going on down here, you know, so we just weren't, you know, it just didn't happen. Then we found each other, and then we figured it out.
I think Tommy and some of the other merchants here kind of saw what was going on in the other Main Street districts, and they've kind of followed suit a little bit, which has helped them get ready to come into the program, actually. And I think that's why people thought they were already a part of the program, is because they are kind of in that close proximity with the neighborhoods that surround downtown Orlando. So they fit in very well with us. But we've been down here a couple of times and brought people down and done walkthroughs and you know, come up with some ideas for things that they could do. Because even though my main function at the city is to run the Main Street program, I've worked with other districts like the Milk District, like Baldwin Park, like some other areas of the city. Right now we're working with Curry Ford that are kind of what we call wannabe districts, and they may not be completely ready to be Main Streets yet, but still I'm in the business development division, and so our main interest is the small business community in Orlando. So, you know, we help everyone. So I've had quite a bit of contact with Tommy and some of the other businesses down here over those years while they were getting ready to come into the program.
So do you reach out to districts first, or do they reach out to you? How does that work?
Well, the Main Street program is very grassroots oriented. So it's not one of those things where we go after a district and say, oh, you're going to fit in our program, we want you in. They really do come to us first. The interesting thing is, when I started in this career, you know, 24 years ago, the way I got started into it was Taco Bell was going to tear down a 100-year-old mansion two blocks from where I lived on the main street in my hometown. And so I got involved with a group to save the building, which now that group of people owns that building.
Which town is that?
It's Galion, Ohio. Very small town in Ohio. And that was how I got started. And over the years in the Main Street program, that's often what happens, is there's usually what we call a catalyst event of some kind that brings people's awareness to go, oh, maybe we need to get organized and do something because other people are seeing the value of this area, and they may be doing something really good, and they may be doing something very detrimental. And so most of the time in Main Street, that's what happens. You see something like what's happening on Curry Ford, or, you know, what's happening here, and people will then say, we have to get organized, and we have to make sure that we manage growth and protect our neighborhoods.
Tommy, how do you see this district, this neighborhood changing in the next 5 to 10 years?
Skate parks complete, more housing, something more sustainable for earth-friendly type stuff, and just kind of the way it is, a mix of everyone, just growing, more people coming, more parking. We need better parking, and Robinson Street needs to get fixed as well, and maybe this county can buy the road back from the state, because it's hard to get anything done on Robinson Street right now. So,
Tommy and Pauline, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Tommy Mott, owner of the Space Bar, and Pauline Eaton from the City of Orlando's Main Street program. Still to come, Orlando Rockers' Captains of April join us for an acoustic set. That's when Intersection returns. This is Intersection. We're in the studio with Captains of April, and they're going to play a song called Molly.
December, we're not who we used to be. If only you can remember, follow me to the willow tree, where we spend our nights laying on the grass, staring at the stars. But the moment passed, we took our time to make amends with a broken world and beauty within. Follow me there, it's not too late, it's not too late. Follow me there, it's not too late, it's not too late. Oh, sweet Molly, can you not see? Oh, sweet Molly, time travel. From here, I'm higher than you'll ever know. Let's take a trip across the stars to anywhere you want to go. I can see your house from here. I'm higher than you'll ever know. Let's take a trip across the stars to anywhere you want to go. Oh, sweet Molly. Oh, sweet Molly,
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty. With us in the studio, Captains of April, Chris Irwin on vocals, Mateo Velez on bass, James Sims on guitar, and Tristan Smith on percussion. So, Chris, tell me about the name, Captains of April. Where does that come from?
That comes from the Portuguese side of my family. In the 1970s, there was a military dictatorship and was overthrown by the military. And the military got called the Captains of April because it happened in the month of April. And when my mom told me that story, I always thought it would be an awesome name for a band. And so I used it.
What about the songwriting process? So there's four of you. How do you come together and collaborate and create these songs?
Well, it started off with just me and Sims kind of writing songs. We got together a long time ago, and we just started putting together songs, patching them together. And then when we got Tristan and Mateo, they threw in their unique style and unique parts and really brought out the best qualities of the song.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about that song you just played, Molly. What was the genesis of that one?
Molly was originally a project that James was working on. He was making like some music for a movie trailer for 16 Candles, just as like a fun project on the side. Mm-hmm. And when we started the band, we really liked the melody that he went with, so we just created a whole song out of it.
And normally you guys are not playing an acoustic set, right? So do you have to kind of reconfigure the way you play? Or
yeah, Matthew. Typically, we're playing, you know, full band, lots of amps. I play bass, so it's a totally different instrument, like two more strings, so I don't even know what to do with them half the time. So what we do is we kind of sit down and take a look at the song structure, the lyrics, the chords, and like Chris said, reinterpret them so that we can get the meaning of the message to, you know, the audience, mm-hmm. but also dial it back. You know, we usually bring a lot of energy to the table, and we want to keep the energy, but more so speak to kind of the core message of the song and the melody and the harmony of it without the typical accoutrements that we bring with it.
All right. So you've got a couple other songs up your sleeves. Tell me a little bit about the next one you're going to play.
Jones was a song I kind of wrote a while back. I wrote the first verse and the chorus, and then I brought it to Chris like a year or two ago maybe, and he wrote the second verse, and then we brought it to the band, and we all wrote our own individual parts, and now it's a cool little jingle we're going to play for you.
And this is James Sims, guitarist for the band?
Yes, Sims.
Shares a love they can't replace. From the beach and to the trees, leaves a man down to his knees on the dark side of the town till the cops come shut us down. I need you, so take me back to where you lay and take me home where it's okay. Say oh, oh. It's over, Jones. She loves no more. She packs her bags but stays a while. Oh, no. After the dark made every moment so it would last. Before the future eats up the past. Hand in hand and side by side, growing up was their demise. He missed you, so take me back to where you lay and take me home where it's okay. It's over, Jones. She loves no more.
Captains of April with a song called Jones. You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. So tell me about your influences. Who do you listen to, or who did you listen to growing up, and does that come through in your music?
I grew up singing a lot of pop-punk bands, and recently I started listening more garage rock, indie rock, stuff like Foxygen, Cage the Elephant, The Strokes, of course. So that's kind of what's been influencing this project. But I also listen to a lot of the local bands around here. There's so much talent. Fiery Sushi, Bothering Dennis, Arcadence, Kind of the Wolves. There's so many great bands in Central Florida, so I'm always excited to go see a local show.
Do you perform a lot with the same bands?
We all kind of follow each other, but there's so many good bands that there's always a good mix. Every time we schedule a show, there's always a new band on the ticket and somebody else we get to meet and have fun on the stage with, so.
And where do you play normally?
A little bit of everywhere. The Mills District, Will's Pub, Uncle Lou's. We have a show coming up at the Hourglass Brewery in Longwood, November 19th.
James, tell me about guitar solos. Do you get to do a lot of them?
Well, I wouldn't say a lot. Like, in the beginning, I was kind of against guitar solos. I thought it was kind of pretentious, you know? Whenever I imagined a guitar soloist, I imagined the cat with the long hair, you know, with the fan blowing in his face. You know, look at my guitar. You know, so I was kind of against it. But as I've grown as a musician, I've kind of embraced it as that's my time. That's my voice. Mm-hmm. You know, that's my time to sing through my guitar solo. So I'll kind of embrace doing more solos.
Tristan, I got to ask you, too. Do you get to do some drum solos as well?
Yeah, so I think that there are a couple parts where I get to kind of let go and be loud. I think with Captains of April, there's a lot of effects that are going on in our live performance, and Mateo can speak more to that as well. Most bands have a bass player with a very deep, clean tone, and Mateo uses two bass amps so that he can have a clean sound on one and then a lot of effects on the other. So I typically try to kind of stay back and hold everything together because I feel that there's a lot of cool textures coming from guitar and bass.
Yeah, it's funny. Usually Chris will introduce himself as the lead singer, Sims as the lead guitarist, and myself as the lead bassist. As Tristan mentioned, I actually do run two amps simultaneously, one with a lot of effects being processed in it, and one with the clean signal just so it doesn't sound like a chainsaw. This band originally, but when I came in, had a rhythm guitarist, and we ended up going with a four-man setup because one amp was able to do the bass and one amp was able to do the rhythm guitar, and it's very fulfilling for me as a bassist because usually, you know, the bass is kind of in the background, but I just kind of sonically like to push through and make myself be heard. I even have some solos sometimes. It's awesome.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I get like way up there. So it's definitely a lot of fun, and it's great to have that creative outlet with these guys. That's kind of why I like playing with them so much is everyone has their time to shine, and we're also very respectful of it. You know, we like to give each other room to demonstrate, you know, our prowess and musicianship, so to speak, and it's a very good environment for self-expression.
You're going to play another song. Tell me about the next one, Breaking Glass.
Breaking Glass, that's one of our newer ones.
The way it started on my end, it was this cool melody I heard. The guitarist from The Smiths, Johnny Marr, I was watching a video with him, and he did this little progression in E, in the key of E, and I liked the little thing that he was doing. So in the beginning of the song, there's this riff that's kind of like inspired by Johnny Marr, and then we just continued on from that riff.
Mm-hmm.
head in the clouds, and I don't think she'll ever come back down. She says she likes it better when she can breathe. He's got his feet on the ground, he's walking right past this old ghost town. He likes it better on the run, you see.
This is Intersection on 90.7. You're listening to a track called Breaking Glass by Captains of April. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Technical direction from Nicole Creston. Our intern is Talia Blake. Find this show and previous episodes on our website at wmfe.org/intersection or wherever you download your podcasts. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.